who nudged the next man, and so on. There was a plate of crackers, cheese squares, and a few slices of bread on a table near the back, and Mary's quick eye told her they'd been out since morning. The cheese had gone hard at the edges. The man behind the bar tucked his apron into his belt and came around. "I'm sorry, but I'm looking for Alfred Brayhuff. Have you seen him? He hasn't been home." "Jesus," one of the men at the bar muttered. "Brayhuff has a home? Are you..."
"You're Mary."
"I am."
"He left a while ago. Did you check with the chestnut man on 30th Street?
Was he..." Mary hoped he wouldn't make her say it. "All right?" The bartender shrugged.
"He was all right, I guess."
Mary tried to decide what to do.
"I think you should go home," the bartender said, as if hearing her thoughts. He had that mopey look that means he's homeward bound.
"What do you know about his looks?" Mary wanted to ask.
"I'll kill him," she vowed. "I'll stand behind the door and get him before he even enters the room."
Fran had killed a man in Jersey City a few years back. Robert was on nights at the time, and the man had broken into their rooms, was standing at the foot of her bed, and she'd grabbed her husband's spare gun from under the pillow, the one he'd left for her for exactly that sort of crisis, and shot him dead.
"Thank you," Mary said to the bartender, and left.
What Alfred did when Mary was away was never clear to her. She wanted to ask Jimmy Tiernan, who lived on the third floor and went to Nations himself sometimes, but whenever she thought she had her chance, Patricia Tiernan appeared over his shoulder and gave her the daggers. Fran didn't have a door on the stairs and claimed to never hear Alfred on the nights he howled. Joan had a mind the size of a thimble, and all that thimble contained were thoughts of future babies she'd have with her husband. Once, when Joan mentioned that they'd been married going on 6 years and hoping all that time, Mary had snapped.
"My God, Joan, do you need the formula written down for you? Do you know what goes into making a baby?"
But as she watched Joan close her eyes against her question, keeping one long, delicate finger on the lid of the coffee pot, Mary realized Joan would never have a baby.
"I've heard it takes a long time for some women," she offered by way of apology.
Joan must have forgiven her because she continued to wave Mary inside whenever she caught her passing. It was useless to ask Alfred himself, because according to him, he never drank more than he could handle, and when Mary was gone, he never drank at all. He only worked, or tried to get work. The longest she'd been gone without returning home was 3 months, but even on the jobs where she was close enough to get home for the odd Sunday, one day was not enough to see what was happening. Who helped him up the stairs when he called and called but never got any answer? Not Mr. Hallinan, who hated both Alfred and Mary. Not Jimmy Tiernan, who wouldn't be allowed out. Maybe he got up the stairs himself. Or maybe he slept wherever he landed. Or maybe he told the truth, that when Mary was gone, he didn't drink at all. Maybe that behavior was something he saved for her. A punishment, perhaps, for always leaving. In some of the homes where Mary had worked, the families had pots and pans by the dozen, sinks with two chambers, ice boxes that could keep a hock of ham frozen for a whole summer. In the room she and Alfred shared, they had one skillet, one tall stock pot for boiling, and one small saucepan. But those three vessels were enough for two, enough for the sort of meals Alfred liked most. That evening, in case he would return, Mary walked downtown from Nation's door, and then east, to the butcher on 2nd Avenue that stayed open until 6. When she finally got there and smelled the raw meat combined with the sawdust on the floor and the fresh herbs on the counter for those who liked to take home their cuts already seasoned, she knew that he would come home. Back in her own silent kitchen, she cleared off the cluttered table and used it to prep. She filled the pot with water. She rubbed the small pork tenderloin she'd purchased, half price with plenty of salt and pepper, a bit of nutmeg she grated, a pinch of cinnamon, a dash of sugar, a teaspoon's worth of onion powder she measured with her cupped hand. After a while, she heard noise on the stairs, steps on the fifth floor landing. She opened the door and waited.
"Mary," he said, and stopped climbing 2 steps from the top. He clutched the railing.
"Are you all right?" she asked. Not seeing him for a long time and then seeing him again was a famine and a feast her body knew the rhythms of better than her mind. The light was dim, and Alfred, with his dark hair and eyes, his dark clothes, threatened to fade into the paneling, the deep wines and forest greens of the cheap wallpaper the building's owner had pasted up so many years ago. Mary couldn't stop herself from walking over to him. She couldn't stop herself from holding out her hand.
He was every bit as handsome as he'd been when she was 17 and he 22. He was every bit as strong. "I'm all right," he said, taking her hand between his and drawing it closer for a kiss. "I made supper," she said to him, tugging him gently up the last two steps until he was standing in front of her. He put his hands on either side of her head and then cupped her face. He clutched her shoulders and pulled her to his chest. "Thank you, Mary. I'm very glad." Things stayed good between them for 2 weeks, and then, like a balloon with the tiniest puncture, they started to sink. He came home later. He wouldn't touch what she cooked. Instead of talking with her in the mornings, he rolled over and stared at the wall until she left to spend the day cooking down at a firehouse social or a church hall or a company picnic or one of the other day jobs she'd arranged by grasping at connections, following up on every rumor, showing up at doors with her knives folded neatly in her bag to say that she heard there was need of a cook. September, October, November, they moved around their rooms, keeping furniture between them. Once, just before Christmas, they'd been about to pass each other on the stairs when Mr. Hallinan stepped out on the landing and said the missus had kicked him out. Alfred and Mary had looked immediately to each other and laughed, she facing up the stairs, he facing down. They'd laughed together at Mr. Hallinan's expense, and for one instant they stepped outside of that particular moment in time. Sometimes, very late at night, he told her he knew that all the cruel things she said to him were the truth. And it was easy to talk to him then, to pile on more and more, because in those moods he would just accept it, tell her she was right, absolutely right. But during the day, whenever she caught him sober and worked up the courage and energy to face this thing that was eating away at them, she'd take a breath to speak, and before she uttered one single syllable, he'd already be cringing, closing his eyes, looking away, bracing himself for the volley that would follow. And it was that cringe before she'd even said a word. Like she wasn't even allowed to speak, like she wasn't even allowed to raise the slightest objection to the way he was living his life, the way he winced before she'd even fully turned from the counter, that had driven her to the office to find a situation that would keep her away from him. She told Mr. Haskell, who ran the agency, that a regular day off to come home didn't matter to her. She was willing to go as far as Connecticut. She'd go up to Tuxedo if they paid her enough, and gave her a private room. "There is one family that just got in touch yesterday," Mr. Haskell said as he went through her file. "Bowen is their name." He looked up to gauge whether the name rang a bell. "There are cooks in front of you, but you have priority in placement." Priority in placement was a phrase she'd seen on her employment file and scribbled on the envelope where her employers gave the agency honest reviews of her work, her person, how she fit with the family, how open she was to suggestion, how she got on with the other staff. That she had this designation made her lucky, Mr. Haskell wanted her to understand, but she still had to be careful. The Warrens might take that same house in Oyster Bay next summer, and the summer after. Did Mary know how many cooks in New York City would love to spend the summer in Oyster Bay? Did Mary know that President Roosevelt had a home there? How could Mary not know it? Every head in town was swiveled toward the ugly brown mansion. Mary gathered that not all of the Warrens' guests had voted for the man, but by God, were they happy to be eating and sleeping and swimming so near. There was sickness in the Warren family over the summer, Mr. Haskell said after reading the letter Mary had carried for him all the way from Oyster Bay. Typhoid. You didn't get it?
No.
Ever had it?
No.
And you stayed on to help nurse those who got it? He glanced at the letter again as if to double-check what was written there.
What else could I do?
I've been near it before and never got it. I helped nurse the Draytons. Remember the Draytons? Mr. Haskell frowned, and Mary felt a clutch of panic. Had she gotten the Drayton job through the agency? She couldn't remember.
I'm sure the Warrens appreciated it very much. Mr. Haskell leaned back in his chair. Did they give you a bonus?
They kept paying me the wage we'd agreed on for August, so I got 3 additional weeks.
And no more?
No more. The more was given in cash and had been deposited in her bank account weeks earlier. Mr. Haskell regarded her for a moment.
"Report to the Bowen residence by noon on Monday," he said.
10. Someone had propped open the doors and the ceiling fans were humming, but none of it made a bit of difference in the sweltering courtroom. Mary heard the creak of Alfred's chair behind her and was about to turn when Mr. O'Neill scribbled a word onto his pad and pushed it toward her. Soper. She looked up to find the guard crossing the room toward him, and one of the other lawyers announcing his full name. "Do not react," Mr. O'Neill had warned her during their preparations. "Show that you are paying attention, but be respectful." Soper stood from his chair as neatly and silently as a paper removed from an envelope and unfolded along the seams. How had he figured it out? Everyone wanted to know. And, oh, how he loved to tell the story. Mary imagined him perfecting that calm remove in front of a mirror at home. How? It was simple. One merely had to be brilliant and determined. She wanted to point out that the story had been in all the newspapers. Surely everyone sitting in the room already knew it, but no. They would give the doctor a platform, and they'd all have to sit through it again. She felt her stomach clench as he sat back in the chair and crossed one leg over the other. Mary closed her eyes, counted to 10. "Dr. Soper," the other lawyer said after listing Soper's credentials, "please explain to us the events leading up to your investigation in Oyster Bay and your conclusion that Mary Mallon was at the root of the outbreak that struck the Warren family in the summer of 1906. Soper relaxed further, placed his hands neatly atop his knees. He was so well rehearsed that Mary wondered if he even had to pay attention to what he was saying. "I was busy with the subway sanitation problems, but there was something about this case that pushed me on the train to Oyster Bay to have a look. I got there in the second week of January 1907, and I'll admit that I was no more clever than the other investigators Mr. Thompson hired, at first. Like them, I initially thought the family might have gotten typhoid after eating soft-shell crabs, and then I thought perhaps it was the water. I dropped blue dye in the commode and then waited to see if the drinking water ran blue. It didn't. I swabbed the tank but found no typhus bacilli. I stayed for 3 days and interviewed shopkeepers in town, a police officer, the postman who delivered mail to the Warrens the previous summer. Except for a governess and a music teacher the Warrens had brought with them from Manhattan, they'd hired all local staff, and I went to their homes and asked them to recall everything they could from the week the illness broke out, who among the household had gotten sick and when. Finally, the stable hand, a man named Jack, mentioned in passing at the conclusion of our interview that he didn't think any of the sick would have made it if it hadn't been for Mary. I double-checked the notes the other inspectors had forwarded me, but none mentioned a servant named Mary. The only cook on my list was a woman named Bernadette Doyle. When I pressed Jack, he said that Mrs. Doyle left at the end of July. Her daughter was expecting a baby that came early, so the Warren sent for another cook. Mary got there on the 3rd day of August. I was calm as I made a note, and then checked it against the first signs of fever. August 18th. You can imagine how exciting this was. The lawyer nodded that he could imagine, and glanced toward the judges. "I wanted to make absolutely certain," Soper continued. "Are you sure about the date?" I asked Jack. "Sure, I'm sure," Jack said. "The day she came was my birthday. She made the best peach ice cream I've ever had, and she was nice to look at." These were Jack's words, you understand. He told me that this cook named Mary stayed on to look after everyone who had come down with the fever. Not until they had all recovered did Mary return home. At that point, it was mid-September. "After that," Soper said, "it was so simple, a child could have figured it out." He described returning to Manhattan and contacting the agency the Warrens had used to find Mary. He had them send a list of all the other families Mary had cooked for through the agency, in addition to the residence where she was currently employed. One by one, the families got back to me reporting typhoid outbreaks within a few weeks of Mary's arrival. I assembled the data, and one afternoon in late February, I went over to the Bowen residence and rang the bell. I was willing at that point to believe it wasn't her fault. As you know, there are still many doctors who cannot accept the theory of a healthy carrier, and I was prepared to explain it to her. I had not expected to be spoken to so rudely and threatened with a knife. I left a note for Mr. Bowen, but when I passed again several days later, I was shocked to see Mary's head disappear into the servants' entrance. And what have you since learned about that note? That the Bowens never received it. Mary could still see the flick of Frank's wrist as he threw the note into the flames. The Bowens had fired him several weeks after Mary's capture, and she hadn't heard anything about him since. Fired for helping her, she considered once again and felt the guilt of that press up against her. Fired for knowing her, for being her friend. "When did you next attempt to speak to Miss Mallon?" the lawyer asked. "A week or so later, at the building where she lives on 33rd Street." Mary noticed that the courtroom seemed to darken around the edges of her vision, and she felt herself pull away. Mary noticed that the courtroom seemed to darken around the edges of her vision, and she felt herself pull away. She felt all over again, the shock of arriving home after a week's work, just getting settled, hearing the knock on the door, and seeing Alfred open it to find Dr. Soper.
"It's very important that I speak with you," Heat said, ignoring Alfred entirely and taking a slight step forward as if he'd been invited inside.
She sipped from the glass of water Mr. O'Neill nudged toward her.
"And?" the lawyer pushed.
Dr. Soper glanced in her direction so quickly that Mary wondered if she had imagined it.
He smoothed the lapel of his jacket. "And I was unsuccessful. Neither she nor her companion would listen. It's possible that the first time I met Miss Mallon I was too abrupt, too scientific about the problem. I'll grant that. I had a sense of urgency when I went to see her at the Bowen residence, and perhaps I didn't consider her feelings. When I visited her at her own rooms, I tried a different tack. When she saw it was me at her door, she shouted, 'What do you want with me?' So I asked her very calmly, 'Haven't you noticed that disease and death follow you wherever you go?'"
He was telling the truth about what he'd said, but Mary remembered his tone, and it wasn't calm. It was an accusation. Still standing at the door, Alfred had looked back and forth between them and then stepped away. She remembered shouting, but not what she'd said. She remembered that he seemed to grow more calm as she got more upset.
"And what was her response?"
"Anger, as far as I could tell. Once again, she came after me with a knife."
A knife with a blade so dull it could barely cut butter, Mary thought. She wanted to argue with him that day, but she couldn't make sense of what he was saying and couldn't get past the jolt of seeing him again. Disease and death didn't follow her any more than they followed anyone else. People had been dying her whole life. First her father in a fire, then her mother of a cough, then a few years later her brother, then her other brother, then her sister in childbirth, then her sister's two babies, and then her beloved Nana while Mary was en route to America. Had they had fevers? She supposed they had, but she couldn't remember. And anyway, those sicknesses that kill a person always come with fever. And in Ireland, they didn't name their fevers. People became sick. They died. She never heard the word typhoid until she came to America.
"Was this the first time you learned that she had a companion?" The attorney checked his notes.
"Mr. Alfred Brehoff?"
"Yes."
"And what can you tell us about that?"
"When I first arrived at the address the agency had provided to me, I saw Mary outside on the stoop, presumably having just arrived home. I was about to announce myself, but a man approached and embraced her. On the street, I assumed she was engaged to be married, but I've since discovered that she is not. It was Mr. Brehoff who answered my knock when I tried to speak to her at the door to their rooms, not 10 minutes later."
"Can you describe their rooms from what little you saw?"
"Mr. Brehoff appeared disheveled. I noted dirty dishes on the press. There was an odor of overripe fruit."
The attorney continued. "Please describe to us what you did after failing for a second time to convince Miss Mallon that she must come in for testing."
"I leaned more heavily on the Department of Health and the NYPD to take action because I knew I would need their help. After finally persuading them, we came up with a plan. We enlisted a female doctor to help, hoping Mary would be more willing to cooperate with a female, but that was not the case."
"And that doctor was Josephine Baker, correct?"
"Yes."
Mary scanned the people on the other side of the room but didn't see Dr. Baker among them. Judge Erlinger called for a lunch recess at noon. Mr. O'Neill suggested they eat together, but Mary wanted to spend the 3/4 of an hour with Alfred. Mr. O'Neill started to protest that they had items to go over, but then he relented.
"I have to send a guard," he said.
Mary found Alfred leaning against the back wall of the courtroom watching her approach. She felt the damp wrinkles in her clothes as she moved closer to him, a rumpled sack of laundry that should be pushed into a basin and wrung out to dry. Her hair had collapsed. She could feel it bobbing at the back of her neck. She was nervous. Alfred took her hand and squeezed it once before leading her into the hall and down the steps outside to the corner, where a man with a pushcart was selling ham sandwiches. The guard stayed a few paces behind. What was it that was different about him? He pulled off his collar and unbuttoned his shirt. He pulled off the shirt's cuffs, rolled up the sleeves, and threw the collar and cuffs in the bushes. Without them, Mary saw that the shirt was worn so thin it was little more than gauze, the outline of his undershirt obvious in the sun. He moved his hand to her waist. She had decided that she wouldn't let him kiss her until she'd said her piece, but now that the moment had arrived, she decided she could spend the rest of her life saying her piece. She hadn't seen him in so long, and here he was,
looking and smelling and moving like Alfred. She waited, but he only touched her cheek.
"I have only half an hour myself," Alfred said.
"Work?"
She doubted it. What job would allow him to show up after noon? But it was a day for letting things go, for keeping peace. She wanted him to look forward to her release, not dread it.
Alfred nodded.
"It started as a day-to-day thing, but they've not said anything about stopping, so I keep showing up and they keep paying me. It's going on 6 months now."
"What is it?"
"The ice trucks, or rather the ice company stable. They let me drive the truck last week when a man was out, but that was just for the week."
"Do you like it?"
Alfred laughed. "You know, you're the only person who's asked that."
"I know if you don't like it, you won't keep going."
Alfred pointed to a step where they could sit.
"For now, I like it. The boss says the horses like me.
There's not much to it, really, except brushing them and feeding them and making sure the stalls are clean. I run the ones who don't get assigned a truck on a given day, and there are a few injured ones, but there's not much to do for them until they heal. If they heal. I had to put one down. That was the only really bad day, and it was hard going back after that. He was hit by another truck on the corner of Madison and 50th, and his leg broke at the ankle. I had to go up there and shoot him."
Alfred put his hand on her hair and traced his finger along her hairline, around her ear, down her neck. He stopped at the collar of her blouse.
"But why are we talking about me? How about you? You look well, Mary. God, it's good to see you."
Mary brought his broad hand to her lips and kissed it. She studied his face.
"You said I was the only one who asked whether you like it?
Who else would ask? I mean, who else have you told?"
Alfred shrugged.
"What do you mean?"
"I tell whoever asks me what I do."
"You seemed surprised that no one else had asked if you liked it? Who would ask that except for me?"
"What are you getting at?"
"Nothing."
"All right."
"I'm only saying that it's a funny thing to say, that I'm the only person who asked that. To say it when you wouldn't expect anyone else to ask that, would you?"
"Mary,
are you seeing someone?"
He pulled his hand away.
"Why would you ask that? Are you? Am I? Are you serious? There's people out there. You're not alone. That gardener. You'd know the lunacy of that question if you'd really read my letters, if you'd written more often. Look, no point discussing it now, Mary, is there? With you coming home?"
"But I told you in the letters how lonely I was, how worried I was about you. If it was you out there, I would have written every week. You know I would."
"Well, you're a better person than I am, Mary. Isn't that it? I'm a beast with no regard for anyone but myself, and you're a paragon of virtue."
It wasn't supposed to go like this. Arguing over a past neither of them could change. Criticizing each other's choices just like they'd been doing before she was taken. She was hurt. She was very hurt. But she had to make her mind change the subject if they were going to be together again once she got home. She'd resolved to not start up on him the first time she saw him after so long, that she'd be pleasant and forgiving, and that they'd start from scratch if he was willing. But, as usual, she found it impossible to stop. Just as her mind was warning her not to say something, her lips were already saying it. Alfred shifted on the step. He wore that expression of disdain that made her so wild before she left, like every word she spoke was something to recoil from.
"And you hardly ever wrote back? I didn't know if my letters were sinking to the bottom of the river."
"I wrote back. A handful of times." "More than that, Mary," Alfred sighed.
"What could I have done? It's been hard for me too, you know."
"Look, the last thing I want to do is argue with you. Not now. I'll be home soon, and that's all that matters."
"About that. Might as well tell you now."
"Tell me what?"
"Home. It isn't on 33rd Street anymore. I moved. Had to. Couldn't afford that place without you. Anna, a few of the women in the building got involved in the Temperance League and were driving me crazy, waiting for me at the bottom of the stairs, sliding pamphlets under the door. A few of them followed me one afternoon saying Bible verses, and when I got to Nations, the men chewed me out for leading them there."
"Alfred, why didn't you tell me?"
They'd lived in those rooms together for 13 years. She loved the place. She imagined she'd always live there. In her letters to him, she'd asked about the place, about the people in the building. Brief as they were, he'd never said anything in his letters about having trouble with the rent, so she'd assumed, hoped, he hadn't gotten too far behind. She tried to shake off her disappointment. Home was wherever Alfred was.
"So where have my letters been going?"
held at the building. Driscoll keeps them for me. I collect them when I'm over in that direction.
Mary didn't know Mr. Driscoll very well, but remembered he was one of the few in the building Alfred liked talking with when they crossed paths. He'd been a florist, Mary remembered Alfred telling her, until his joints got so painful he couldn't work anymore.
And where have you been staying?
Orchard Street.
Oh, Christ. It's not bad. I rent my bed from a family and meals are included. There's a son, Samuel.
What's their name?
Meany.
Mary wondered where her things were now. Her pots and pans, her clothes, the silver teapot that had been Aunt Kate's.
Let it go, she breathed. Let it go.
She reached for every piece of information he gave her and tried to make the parts fit into a whole. Alfred coming and going on Orchard Street, sitting down for meals with a family she'd never seen. Careful of himself around Samuel, heading out to the Crystal Springs stables and working a full day. She wanted to ask him about drinking, if Mrs. Meany waited up for him, if they helped him to his bed at night and took off his socks and shoes and reminded him to wash his sheets once a week.
"So where will I go later today?" Mary asked. "Come to the stable. I'll be there late anyway. My room on Orchard isn't big, and with the boy there I doubt they'll allow you to stay, or you could stay with someone until we get a place of our own again? Someone in the old building?"
Mary heard her name called from the end of the alley. The break was almost up, and Mr. O'Neill wanted to go over what would happen next before they reconvened. Her guard had fallen asleep with his hat pulled down low over his eyes. She wouldn't be foolish enough to try to escape today, anyway. Not when she'd be free in a matter of hours.
"I have to go," Alfred said. "I'm late as it is."
They brushed the crumbs off their laps, and then he took her into his arms and hugged her, lifting her off the ground for a moment before setting her back down.
"I'm sorry, Mary. I'm sorry I didn't tell you. We'll figure it out later, when we see each other. We'll figure it all out, I promise."
He told her the address of the stable.
"Yes, okay. Later."
"A lot has changed, Mary. You'll see." She'd been a child when she met Alfred, only 17. More than 20 years of her life tied to this person. No way to untangle that knot now. They'd moved into the rooms on 33rd Street in the summer of 1894. When Mary was 25. Aunt Kate had died of pneumonia over the winter, and Patty Brown had gone from saying very little to saying nothing at all.
"Kate loved Alfred," Mary said gently to the old man on the day she told him that she'd be moving out, that she and Alfred had found a place together.
"Kate thought he would marry you," Patty Brown said as he felt along the mantel for his tin of tobacco.
Mary found it for him, pried it open, removed a plug and offered it on her palm. When he got the pipe started, she sat by him, and he put his hand on the top of her head.
"Take the things she wanted you to have," he said after a while.
It was the longest conversation they'd had in 6 months.
For weeks after moving in together, after arranging the few things she'd brought from Kate's, after going to the market and buying new bed linens to fit their new double bed, and a bright yellow tablecloth for their new kitchen table, she thought she'd never rest again. What woman could rest with him so near? And even when he fell asleep, she'd lie awake, contemplating the weight of his arm where it lay across her ribs, the gentle tug she felt when the stubble of his jaw got caught on her hair. When she worked, all she could think about was getting home to him, and he said it was the same for him. They talked late at night over coffee, when they went to bed, when they woke up, and when they weren't together, they stored up all the things the other would be interested in and carried those items home. Even when winter came and the gas meter jar was often empty, they simply crawled into bed together and piled every blanket on top and then shivered with their hands cupped over their mouths. He'd take her frozen feet and pull off the layers of stockings until they were bare, and then he'd lift up his sweaters and press her feet to his warm chest. When Mary thought of those days now, she could still feel that astonished joy, that belief that no one else in the world could possibly be happier than they were. Alfred hugged her again and released her again, and there was something in the hug and the release that told Mary something was not right. Again, Mr. O'Neill shouted her name. The guard came over and stood beside her. It was the time, probably. 27 months could make any two people a little awkward together, even two as close as Mary and Alfred. Also the guilt, Mary remembered. Alfred was always like a hangdog when he was guilty, and she shouldn't have ridden him for not writing more often. Not when they were about to be happy and together again. Alfred working, eating 3 square meals, home at nights. Maybe leaving 33rd Street was a good thing.
Now they can get a new place together and truly start over. I love you, Mary. I really do.
All right, Alfred, Mary said. We'll talk about that later.
We will, he agreed. Together, they walked down the alley toward Mr. O'Neill, who was pointing to his watch and frowning. Everyone came back from lunch recess more overheated and red-faced than when they left. A few of the reporters did not return at all, and Mary wondered if that was because they'd felt certain of the outcome, and if so, what their predictions had been. She noticed Dr. Baker sitting in the second row. The men seated beside her had their backs to her, talking to other men. The scientists talked about new discoveries in the world of contagious diseases, new vaccines that were in development, how it was likely that more people like Mary would be discovered, people who carried disease but never succumbed to it themselves. They used the words bacilli, serum, agglutinins, words that made Mary feel like her mouth was stuffed full of cotton that she couldn't manage to spit away. Eventually, they began discussing her capture, specifically why Dr. Soper and the Department of Health decided to take her by force. It would be one thing if this woman were an educated person, the Department of Health officials argued one by one, but Mary Mallon had no formal education and lived with a man of low moral character to whom she was not married. Several employers had reported that they didn't like to cross Mary, didn't like to demand veal when she'd planned on poultry, and that wasn't natural, was it? What kind of cook inspires that kind of caution in an employer? Mrs. Proctor of East 70th Street recalled a time when she'd asked Mary to make Irish stew, assuming it would be one of her specialties, and Mary refused. When Bette answered the door of the Bowen residence on that cold March morning in 1907, the police officers pushed past her and spread throughout the house. "She's not here," Bette shouted, and the note of urgency in her voice reached Mary, who was up on the third floor. She pulled back the curtain of the nearest window to see the police truck. She heard someone running up the back stairs and discovered that she couldn't move. "The police are here," Frank said the instant he appeared at the door. "I have an idea." Mary saw the solution before he said it out loud. "The Allisons," she said. The Allison family, who lived next door to the Bowens, had recently had a piece of their fence cut open behind the homes so that their servants could travel back and forth. Mrs. Allison and the children had left for Europe a week earlier, and Mr. Allison would be at his office all day. Frank held up his hand as they listened to the brisk footsteps of the officers walking through the rooms of the floor below them. "You listen for your chance," he said. Mary nodded and felt suddenly very cold. Her whole body was covered in a thin layer of sweat, and she began to shiver. Her coat was downstairs in the servants' closet, and there would be no time to get it. It was snowing outside. Only seconds later, Mary heard Frank shout from the first floor, and then the rush of hard-soled shoes to the stairs. Mrs. Bowen was out shopping. Mr. Bowen was at his office downtown. It was supposed to be an ordinary Friday, a better than ordinary Friday, since Mary would have to cook only for the staff, and for them it would be easy. No serving, dinner together around the table in the kitchen. Clutching the doorknob for help, Mary peeked into the empty hall. She stepped out and stayed close to the wall until she got to the narrow back stairs. Down she went, silent as a cat, until she reached the back door of the house. Outside, the snow was falling faster. Feeling nothing but her own heart beating in her chest, she ran along the footpath that led over to the fence and unlatched the door that led from the Bowen's yard to the Allisons. When she looked back to see if anyone was watching her, she noticed her footprints in the snow. She hurried back to cover her tracks and then, walking backward, leaned over to brush away the footprints with her hands. The door to the Allison kitchen was locked, the servants mostly having been let go while the family was in Europe. At the edge of the yard was a supply shed. It was a small structure, little more than a low closet with a roof, but the door was unlatched, and when she stepped inside, there was just enough room among the pruning shears, the bags of sand, and the drums of kerosene for one person to crouch and wait. She didn't feel the cold at first, and considered herself well protected in the little room. But after a while, she could feel the wind where it slipped in between the spaces in the planks, and her knees ached from crouching. She shifted a few bulky canisters of oil and made room to sit on the packed dirt ground. She wished she could hear what was happening on the Bowen side of the fence. Would Frank or Bette remember to get her once the police officers gave up and moved on? There was nothing to do but wait. Later, Mr. O'Neill would ask her what she made of Dr. Soper's pursuit, why she wasn't more surprised to be hounded the way she was.
"I was surprised," Mary said. "I was shocked."
"But you didn't behave like a person who was surprised and shocked," he insisted. You behaved like a person who expected to be pursued. Do you understand the difference? You reacted too quickly. How did you know, when you looked out the window and saw the police, that it was you they'd come for? That's the problem they have with you. That's part of the reason they don't believe you when you claim to have had no idea you were spreading disease. I'm not spreading disease. You see, even there, you sound like a person who's been defending yourself for years, long before anyone accused you. Meaning? Meaning, there must have been a moment when it crossed your mind that all of this was true. The question they have is whether it occurred to you after their accusations or before. I don't understand. You do understand. Think. Alone in the silent supply shed, Mary tried to think about only nice things. Normal things. What she needed from the grocers, what she'd cook for Alfred next time she went home. But instead, she kept thinking of the officers searching for her. She thought of the people who'd been sick in Oyster Bay, and how she'd known they would make it if she worked to keep the fever down. It was a fast-moving fever, that one. Doctors talked about fevers as if they were all the same, but there were fevers, and there were fevers, and Mary could distinguish one from another with the touch of her hand. One day, everyone was playing tennis, riding horses, and the next, they complained of being dizzy. They stopped eating. The gardener vomited very near the water cistern. Mrs. Warren fainted on the porch. Mary had seen it enough times to know that Mrs. Warren and the other adults who caught it would survive. They were in pain, yes, and called out nonsense, and tossed and turned and sweated through all their sheets and vomited bile. Still, Mary had seen typhoid fever at its worst. She'd seen death come a few times, and in each of those times the fight was mismatched from the beginning. The Warren girl was the only real worry, the poor child, only 8 years old. She didn't have the fight in her that the others had. That was the dangerous moment, when the patients didn't have the fight, when they just slept and stared and preferred to keep their eyes closed, when the moaning stopped, when the nonsense stopped. And that girl was so quiet to start with. Mary threw her whole body into beating death away from the girl. She filled the tub to the brim and reached her own hand in the water to show her what it was like to splash inside the house, over the wood of the floor, a thing that would never be allowed if everyone were healthy. And the girl seemed interested in that. Mary told her about her passage to America and what Ireland was like. The girl would never go to Ireland. England, maybe, Mary informed her. Paris, but not Ireland. Not many went to Ireland. They just went away from it. But it was her home, just like New York City was the girl's home. And what was it the poet said? Every savage loves his native shore. And that's when she knew the girl would survive. She leveled her eyes on Mary, and there was life behind them. Are you a savage, Mary? I am, like we all are. And the girl considered it. I'm not, she said. No? Absolutely not. So the Warren girl survived, and everyone else in the Warren house survived, and they still wanted her. That's part of what was so worrying about the Bowen girl, that they wouldn't let her anywhere near. If she could only just see her, but even now, with the police searching the house for her, Mary was sure the girl's nurse had not so much as stepped out into the hall to see what was going on. When they knocked on the door to pass in ice and fresh linens, the nurse blocked their view of the girl's bed with her body, accepted what was given, and shut the door again. Then she thought of the boy, the Kirkenbauer baby, only 2 years old. Just two. Barely two. Crouched in the Allison storage shed, her hands stinging with the cold, she tried everything to keep him out. She hummed songs. She recited poetry. After returning home from the Kirkenbauers back in 1899, she didn't even look for another situation for a whole month. She made sandwiches and sold them to the men who worked at the lumber yard on 21st Street. When they handed over their coins and she handed over the sandwiches, they were perfect strangers to her, and she decided that that was what she wanted. To cook for people, but not to know them at all. She didn't want to see people when they woke up in the morning. She didn't want their children hugging her legs and learning her name. Mary waited in the shed for what felt like hours. She was hungry. She was stiff and cold and worried about getting sick. Who would cook for the Bowens if she got sick? She unwound a long piece of burlap from around the garden equipment stored on a shelf behind her and wrapped it around her shoulders. She hugged her knees to her chest and exhaled hot breath on her fingers. At one point, she thought she heard Bette calling her, so she opened the door and saw a policeman's hat moving along the other side of the fence. She tried not to think about time, and whether she'd be there all night, whether she should risk running alongside the Allisons' house and out to the sidewalk and away downtown. In one moment, she felt sure they'd give up, go home, and never come for her again, and in another moment, she knew they'd be waiting for her on 33rd Street. They'd be waiting for her everywhere she went. After what felt like several hours of almost perfect stillness, she heard the creak of the fence door swinging open, the crunch of footsteps in the snow. "Frank," she prayed, "come to tell her the coast was clear?" She heard footsteps pass her little shed, the shadow of a man darkening the slim spaces of sky between the wood slats. A person was standing at the shed, facing it. Mary could feel the stranger sizing up the little structure, the perfect hiding place.
"Mary Mallon?"
a man called out. The world was thin, brittle, frozen solid, and the man's voice threatened to crack everything open, smash all the lovely icicles hanging from branches. She pressed her lips together and closed her eyes. More steps approached to join the person already at the shed. A woman's voice, efficient, fed up, stood out from the others. "She's in there," the woman said, as if it should have been obvious to everyone, and in one last surge of hope, Mary imagined her pointing her finger away from the storage shed to the trees, to the clouds.
"Mary Mallon," a man said again, and it was the tone in his voice that told Mary it was over.
He really did know she was in there, and he'd give her a moment to decide to come out before he went in and got her. Someone pulled the lever that opened the door, and four men and one woman leaned in to look at her. Mary's hips and knees felt like a kitchen scissors gone to rust. "I'm not going anywhere," Mary said as she worked to ignore the searing pain in her joints. "Leave me alone."
"Mary Mallon," one officer said, "you are under arrest. You have..."
She shoved him. She put her head down and threw out her arms and shoved him. When another officer approached, she kicked, and next thing she knew, one was trying to pin her arms while another had gotten her around her waist. She felt one at her ankles. She reached out and grabbed a handful of the woman's hair. The snow in the Allisons' backyard was churned up, and Mary felt the wet of her skirt through her thick wool stockings. One of the men caught her left arm, and when he did, he twisted it around behind her back. When she turned to knee him, another officer grabbed her right arm. They lifted her, carried her across the Allisons' small yard to the narrow path that ran beside the Bowens' house. She tried to kick, to buck, to twist in their arms, raising her knees in the air, and then letting fly with every bit of strength she had left. But she was stiff from sitting in the cold for so many hours, and her movements felt clumsy, poorly aimed. One of the officers was telling her to be quiet, relax, that she was only making everything worse for herself. And next to all of this buzzed Dr. Baker, who rushed up to the door of the truck and pulled it open so that the men could shove Mary inside. Dr. Baker walked to the front of the courtroom. It was the pattern of the day. One description of Mary in a given moment was not good enough. They had to get two, three, four people up there to say the same thing. One of the police officers had already had his turn and had told them all about it. Said Mary was an animal, worse than an animal, because even the wildest animal can be coaxed, usually. There was no coaxing Mary that day. No reasoning with her. She was like no other person he'd arrested in his life. He had scratch marks on his arms and neck for days. As Mary observed, the plain-looking woman turned to the judge before taking her seat. She knew it would look worse that she'd attacked a woman, and Dr. Baker was a smaller woman than Mary, and a woman of the class that allows women to become doctors. But Dr. Baker surprised her. She admitted that she'd had to sit on Mary during the ride to the Willard Parker Hospital, but other than that, she said simply that Mary had seemed frightened, and that the others had covered for her. As anyone would expect them to, she added. Being Miss Mallon's friends. No one else had said anything about her having friends. "Dr. Baker, did you find her to be unreasonable?" Dr. Baker hesitated. "We didn't try to reason with her. When she went missing, we focused on finding her, and when we found her, we simply forced her into the truck, so I couldn't comment on that. Other than two brief conversations we had when she was still being held at Willard Parker, I've never spoken to Mary Mallon at any length." "Wouldn't you agree that a woman who hides in a shed for so many hours to avoid arrest has a guilty conscience?" Again, Dr. Baker hesitated. "I would say that person doesn't want to be arrested, guilty or not guilty. And I would say that none of us here would like to be arrested." Dr. Baker stared out across the heads of all the witnesses in the gallery, her hands folded neatly in her lap.
The attorney asking the questions searched through several sheets of paper and then pushed them aside and turned to Dr. Baker without notes. Dr. Baker, as a resident of New York City and as a medical doctor, would you feel comfortable letting Mary re-enter society, allowing her to leave North Brother Island and return to her former life? Dr. Baker frowned. She remained silent for a long time, and in the gallery, the spectators wondered if she'd heard the question. Finally, she spoke. It's my opinion that Mary Mallon does not understand the medical threat she is to those around her. However, neither do many of the medical personnel who've become acquainted with her case in these past 2.5 years. I can only say that I don't think Miss Mallon should be allowed to cook. All the medical doctors in this room have admitted that she is a healthy person. What happens when more healthy carriers are discovered? Do we send them all to North Brother? Mr. O'Neill smiled in his seat. The other attorney frowned. Dr. Baker, the other attorney asked, is it possible that you have particular sympathy for Miss Mallon because she is a female? Dr. Baker tilted her head and considered, perhaps. 11. In the end, it took several more days for the judges to decide what to do with her. Instead of sending her all the way back to North Brother for the night, they put her in a hotel, with guards posted outside her room, and on the morning of the second day, 10 minutes were wasted in arguing over who would foot the bill for such a luxury. The city of New York? Which department? One of the DOH representatives shouted, "That woman is expensive enough as it is." She spent 3 nights in the hotel, all told, and except for the fact that her bed was made every afternoon when she came back from the hearing, it wasn't that different from North Brother. The hotel laundry wouldn't lend her an iron, so she gave in and sent her skirt and blouse downstairs for them to clean, which they did, in plenty of time for each morning's proceedings. The mousy girl who brought up her clothes on the morning of the fourth day said, "Good luck to you, missus. We hope they let you go." And Mary imagined a whole staff of women standing behind her, rooting for her, waiting to hear what would happen. And then, back in the oppressive courtroom at 10 o'clock in the morning on July 31st, 1909, Judge Erlinger stared out across the heads of every man and woman in the room and announced that Mary Mallon's release would be a hazard to every New Yorker and could not be justified. She would be returned to North Brother Island immediately. Mary heard the words as a kick to the gut and gripped the table to steady herself. "What does it mean?" she demanded of Mr. O'Neill. Everyone in the room seemed to have woken up. Some of the reporters jumped from their seats to shout questions at the judge or at the collection of experts, at Mr. O'Neill, at Mary. "It's just for now," Mr. O'Neill said. "We'll keep working. Look, their own experts said there are others like you that..."
"Others like me? Do you believe I'm giving out the fever? I think it's irrelevant, Mary. I've tried not to think about it too much, but yes, the lab work is sound in my view, and 2/3 of the time it comes back positive. Their labs, run by their people. I'm telling you, it's Soper. He's..."
"Mary, calm down, please.
It doesn't matter.
What matters is that you are perfectly safe to be around as long as you are not cooking, and they can't go locking up healthy people whenever they feel like it. There has to be a better solution."
Mary absorbed Mr. O'Neill's calm response and remembered that for him and for everyone else in the courtroom, the hearing was no more than a handful of days, a set of hours, an errand, an item on a list. For Mary, it was her entire life. After this, Mary made herself understand all of them can go home to their families, meet someone for a picnic, take a trip to the ocean if they want. Each person here has complete freedom, except for me. When she thought about going back, the long automobile journey uptown, the ferry crossing to North Brother, it all seemed inevitable, and all the other possibilities she'd imagined, being with Alfred, getting new rooms together, finding work, were just dreams behind locked doors. "The judges said you can have visitors now," Mr. O'Neill offered by way of consolation. "You can write to your friends and let them know." Mary stood on her tiptoes so that she was almost his height and felt tempted to spit at him, to walk up to the judges and spit at them as well. As for Soper, she felt her hands turn to fists. Their experts had worried that she had a violent streak. What proper woman would raise a knife to a man of status? And perhaps they were right. Who among her friends, after not seeing her for more than 2 years, would put aside their work to spend half a day traveling all that way uptown, all the way across Hellgate, to sip a cup of tea in her cramped kitchen for 30 minutes? And how would Alfred react to this news? She was glad he was absent.
John Kane was there to meet her fairy and tell her all the news since she left. The she-cat who skulked in the vegetable garden had birthed a litter of kittens, and all the babies had been taken home by nurses except for one. Did Mary want it? For company? The hydrangea by the south wall were fully bloomed in the heat, even though he didn't expect that for several more weeks, since last year they hadn't blossomed until August. Did Mary remember? Did she remember planting the rusted nails with him? Well, it worked, that trick, and now they flowered a deep periwinkle blue. He went on and on, as if she'd been gone for a year and not just a handful of days. The moment she opened the door to her cottage, it was as if she'd gone out only for a walk, and everything, the courtroom, the judges, Dr. Soper, the hotel, seemed like a hallucination, like she'd never left, like she'd never seen Alfred at all. He'd tried to see her at the hotel the first evening, but they told him to see her over at the courthouse. He never did. Working, she supposed. He could have left a note with the clerk at the courthouse or one of the guards at the hotel. Even if they had to read it before handing it over, she'd like to have had a note from him. But there was no note, no visit, and now she was back on North Brother with John Kane buzzing in her ear. She went over to her desk and removed a sheet of paper. She sat up for a while, not sure of what to say. After a few minutes, she picked up the pen. "Alfred, you've heard by now that I was taken back to North Brother. Mr. O'Neill said he's going to keep trying. I'm not sure what to think. I'm just so tired. I barely saw you at all. I'm allowed to have visitors now. I would love for you to visit me here, Alfred. It's not ideal, but at least it's something. I'll wait to hear from you. Mary." She addressed the letter to the stable instead of 33rd Street and left it poking out from under her doormat on the step where the mailman would notice it. Then she closed the door of her cottage and curled up on her cot. Her body smelled ripe. Her best blouse would be ruined for good. It was so very hot, the walls so close. Late at night, when she was sure no one would see her, she carried the heavy chamber pot outside, emptied it in the river, and returned immediately to bed. In the early mornings, she heard the foghorn of the lighthouse behind the hospital. She listened to the rhythmic tap and scrape of the bricklayer's instruments as he pointed the brick of the new walkway that connected the hospital to the outbuildings. She heard John and his gardening shears slicing through the green, and she heard someone leave meals on her step 3 times a day. After a few days, she decided that was the way it would be from now on. She'd stay in her hut, and if they needed her, let them break the door down. If they wanted her samples or wanted to draw blood, by God, they'd have to drug her and get 10 men to hold her. No more. After several days, her head felt light from lack of food, her teeth thick and soft, and under her arms itched for a scalding washcloth rubbed with strong soap. John pounded on her door and warned her that he'd brought a nurse and they were going to enter without an invitation if she refused to come outside. Finally, as threatened, he opened the door, and the smell of fresh-cut grass turned her stomach. "My God," he said, turning his face toward the fresh air of outdoors and drawing a deep breath. "Are you suffocating yourself?" "Get out." "I've brought Nancy," he informed her, as if she knew who in the world Nancy was, as if she cared. "Tell her," John urged the girl. The nurses got younger every season. Nancy looked at him and then at Mary. "Tell her," he said again, nodding toward her hand. Mary noticed the girl was holding a newspaper. "There's a dairyman," Nancy said, "in Camden, upstate." Mary waited. The girl whispered something to John, but he couldn't hear her. Mary promised that she'd kill them both with a single shot if they didn't get out. "They say she gets mad if..."
"If what?" John asked.
"Yes, if what?" Mary asked. The girl took a step backward. "If anyone says anything about her having the fever..." Mary sat up in her cot.
"Don't worry about that," John assured Nancy. "Just keep going."
"There's a dairyman in Camden who's passing the fever through the milk." Mary sat up straighter. "What do you mean?" John took over. "She's just after reading it to me. He's a dairyman. Had the fever 40 years ago and hasn't been sick a day since. There were outbreaks of typhoid wherever his milk was sent, at groceries and markets all over New York City, and now they've traced it to him. Got lots of people sick with it. They're saying maybe hundreds. More than what?" "More than they claim you made sick. A lot more." "Where are they sending him?" "Not here, I guess. Camden is all the way up near Syracuse, isn't it?" "That's just it. They're not sending him anywhere." "What do you mean?" Because he's the head of his household and has a family, they've decided it would be too much of a hardship to put him in quarantine. So he can stay exactly where he is, as long as he promises to never have anything to do with milk production. So he has his sons running it, and he's bossing them.
You mean they're isolating him somewhere in Camden? Somewhere he can be near his family?
No, Mary. I mean they're letting him stay in his own damn house. You understand? With his wife. With his dogs and his sons and his grandchildren. Not a thing has happened to this man except being told not to go near the milk that's distributed for sale. As for the family's milk, he can do as he pleases. None of them have ever had typhoid, so your Dr. Soper believes they must be immune.
Soper. Soper went up there.
Mary tried to make sense of what she'd just been told.
Hundreds, you said? Hundreds? They say I infected 23.
It was one of the rare times she'd said it out loud.
Nancy piped up. I think, if I may, that you're considered more of a, well, a special case. There's a bit on you at the end here.
She held out the folded newspaper for Mary to take.
This man knew he had typhoid 40 years ago. He remembers it well. You claim to have never had it at all, so...
I claim, Mary said. She advanced toward the girl with her arm stretched out for the paper, which the girl handed over before backing away.
You can go now, please, and tell the other nurses not to bother coming down here with any more glass canisters for collecting, or they won't like what I do with those canisters when they get here. I'm finished with all that, you understand?
I understand. When the girl had left, John announced that he was going to sit on the step outside where the air flowed a little easier.
She was trying to help, Mary, he remarked over his shoulder. She didn't have to tell me about that article, but she did. She said she thought you should know.
Everybody's trying to help. And look where all their help has landed me.
She scrutinized the back of John's head for a moment, his sunburned neck, and then, sighing, went over to sit beside him.
If you hadn't bit Nancy's head off, she would have also told you that the article says there are likely many, many more like you and this man up in Camden. It says the Department of Health already has leads on several of them from tracing local outbreaks.
And none of them are in quarantine?
Nope.
Mary tried to ignore the reek of her body and looked over at the moon. Just an impression, yet, the sky still blew around it. Her muscles felt weak from lying in a prone position for so long. She leaned over to the tray John brought with him and broke off a piece of the bread.
But I was first, so I get the prize.
I guess so.
John plucked a blade of grass and stuck it in his mouth. He leaned back on his elbows and closed his eyes.
I like it out here, days like this. Feels like the country. And this island gets a good breeze compared to over there.
He lifted his chin to indicate the water, the tall buildings on the other, larger island to the west. He sat up.
Oh, before I forget, I cleared a path down on the other side, you know, by that heron's nest you found that time. It goes all the way down to the beach, and you can't see the hospital from there if you walk down a bit and get the trees between you and it.
Mary imagined him doing all of this, making progress through the weeds and brambles, overgrowth that had not been touched in years, maybe ever. His arms were berry brown from being outdoors. She wondered sometimes if he was strong enough for all the work he did. Perhaps it was the work that kept him strong. He must be well into his 50s, maybe more. But then Mary remembered that she was almost 40. 40 years old. Her own mother had died at 30, her Nana at 58. When had he cleared that path with everything else he was supposed to be doing? He said the board of the hospital wanted primroses along the eastern gable, mums added to the garden. They wanted the lawns cut, the hedges kept trim, everything about the island as neat and orderly as the corridors of the hospital. Riverside was a showpiece hospital, an example to all the other hospitals built to house and study contagious diseases. But John had his own way of doing things, just as Mary had her own ways of operating around a mistress who believed she knew her kitchen better than Mary did. If he was wanted for anything, a messenger could always follow the smell of his pipe, which he took out of his shirt pocket now and stuffed with tobacco. So he'd been sure all along that she would be back. Or maybe it occurred to her now he'd just been hopeful.
Thank you, John.
John nodded as he touched his match to the tobacco and drew it alive with short, careful puffs.
Did you see your man over there at the hearing?
I did.
Good, John said.
That's good.
She spent August and September prowling the edges of the island. Every morning started cooler than the last, and soon she had to bring her shawl for warmth. She walked without stockings on the packed sand and held her shoes in her hands as she stepped from smooth stone to smooth stone that led, if she chose to follow, out into treacherous waters.
She rested on the southernmost point of the island and found South Brother, the smaller sibling of North Brother. From her point of view, the other island looked green and thick and far happier without the insult of quarantine hospitals and daily death. Sometimes, if she was very still, a snowy egret came to stand by her and inspect her, its plumage so pure and beautiful that Mary wondered how it could be an inhabitant of the same place as the other living things, all of which struck Mary as filthy and tired, just as Mary was. Sometimes, with the sun behind the bird and with its plumage on display, the delicate creature glowed and felt to Mary like a sign that good things were possible. No one ever looked for her anymore. In the beginning, if she didn't answer the door of her cottage and couldn't be found in one of the flower beds close by, they'd send out a search party. "I thought I was free to roam as I please," Mary would say, furious at yet another promise broken, and doubly angry because they always responded, "Oh, you are, of course you are," even as they led her back by the elbow, the glass canisters clinking in their skirt pockets. Never in her life had she had so much time. She tried to remember being a child, but even those years seemed full of responsibilities. Fetching and boiling water, cleaning, baking, gardening, raking, doing her lessons by the lamp while her Nana used her quick knife to separate potatoes from their jackets and pile them high on the table. The nurses never came near her now, and she wondered if that had been part of the judge's order, the fine print she hadn't stayed around to read, that although she had to stay within the ordered boundaries, no one was to bother her with tests and analyses, no one was to rap on her cottage door twice a week. Several weeks after the hearing, the middle of September 1909, Mary got a letter from Alfred. When she saw the mail carrier headed toward her cottage, she figured it was just another update from Mr. O'Neill and didn't bother hurrying to intercept him. When she saw the handwriting on the envelope, her hands went sweaty. She studied it for a moment, and then she tore it open. "Dear Mary, I hope they told you I tried to see you at the hotel where they kept you. I don't know why they wouldn't let me. I don't remember if I told you that I thought you looked very beautiful the day that I saw you, and I'd almost forgotten, truth be told, how beautiful you are. I'm writing now because I'd like to go up there to see you. I had hoped that you'd be free and there wouldn't be any need, but now I worry it will be even longer. Maybe another 2 years even, maybe more. I've inquired about the ferry, and since it doesn't go on Sundays, except for the hospital people, I will plan on seeing you there a week from Saturday. Maybe you can let the correct people know that I'm coming so they don't give me any trouble when I get there. We can take a walk or do whatever it is you do to pass time. I just want to see you. Until then, Alfred Breihoff." There were several details about this letter Mary didn't like. For a start, there was, "I'd almost forgotten." Nor did she like 2 years, maybe more. Most of all, she did not like the formality of his signature, Alfred Breihoff. 12. Alfred had a pushcart once. He'd had many jobs, but the pushcart months stood out. He said he was sick of hauling coal baskets, and even more sick of emptying ash cans, and above everything, sick of answering to a boss. He had had just about every type of physical employment a man could have, and his body needed a break. By his own description, he was a genial person and liked to look his fellow man in the face. So he went out and rented a pushcart for 25 cents a day. "It's standing, Mary," he said, "standing and talking, and making a living, besides." Alfred preferred to sit while talking, and preferred most of all to sit with a glass of strong liquor nearby, but Mary didn't point out any of this. It was possible, she supposed, for him to know himself a little better than she knew him, so she swallowed her concerns and said it was a great idea. She knew the butchers of the east side better than he did, knew which one of them kept their thumbs on the scales, which stored their meat on cellar floors where the rain seeped in and sewer pipes might burst. So she helped him find a supplier. There were already 3 poultrymen on the street where he planned to set up, so he started out selling cuts of beef, pork, and lamb. For a quick lunch, to make his cart known, he offered slabs of corned beef with a side of beans, a boiled potato for an extra 5 cents. Mary showed him how to keep it hot, how much to put on the plate. By the end of the very first month, he learned that meat was not the thing. Fat, black flies pestered him all day long, laying their eggs while doing so, and made themselves so at home on his cart that he was forced to switch to fruit. The Jewish and Italians had the advantage with the fruit suppliers, taking all the semi-rot for themselves and leaving to the rest of the peddlers only the best fruit, for which the suppliers had to charge full price. Between the cost of the good fruit and the cart and the tipping of police officers and the paying off of the grocer from whom he rented a sidewalk space,
plus the nod to the collector and the man of influence, who was no more than a saloon keeper up the block. Alfred was deep in the red after only 2 or 3 more months. On top of that, since he was set up next to one of the poultrymen, the flies came anyway, and hopped from the putrid carcasses the other peddler had cast behind his cart over to Alfred's lovely apples and pears, where they perched and laid more eggs. Once he gave up on fruit, he switched to hot corn, and that went all right for a while, maybe 3 or 4 months. But he got bored with corn and switched to something that no one else for 10 blocks thought to sell. Children's toys. Small toy boats. Wooden horses. Dolls for girls. Noisemakers. Funny hats. Toys were the best yet. Alfred opened his cart for business around 9 in the morning and closed before supper by 4. There was no worry about rot. No worry about his goods baking in the sun. Even the children left him alone except to buy what he offered. When the fruit carts got pelted with their own goods and the fish cart got overwhelmed, overturned, and rolled down Forsyth Street, Alfred was left alone to sell for 5 cents what he'd purchased for 3. When Mary looked back on the best days with Alfred, leaving out the early days, when they were both so young and had nothing in the world to do but spend their days off taking walks or sipping coffee, the time that Alfred spent as a toy vendor was the happiest in their entire history.